Hi everybody, welcome back. I've just been interrupted in talking about the latest book I'm reading. In fact, the rare thing about this book is that it's the only book that I can remember in the last maybe 35 years that I've read in one sitting. And, you know, Jules found it in a bookshop when we were at the airport and came back and said, Dad, guess what? Guess what the name of this book is? And I said, where is it? Because I went and grabbed it and started reading and didn't put it down until I stopped because I'm so fascinated. The name of the book is Lifespan, Why We Age and Why We Don't Have To. That should be enough for you, right? But I showed that to my sister the other day and said, look at this. And she goes, what's that about? So, so it's about living to 150 by taking care of yourself with a couple of pretty smart things that many of you are up to already. So, you know, I'm kind of standing here of living proof that intermittent fasting works. If you want to lose, at this stage I've lost 12 kilos, I've got another 2 to go. So my target is 80. I worked with being 80 kilos, or it was 94 when I started. I've been working on getting to 80 kilos for how long, Leslie? I think it's 2017. I made a commitment with Leslie that I was going to get to 80 kilos and I just blew it and didn't get there. And I knew that I needed to lose the weight and I knew that I needed to do it from an integrity point of view. You know, you can't really go around teaching how to be fit and healthy without being fit and healthy. So, you know, time came for me to make that move in a way I did. So it's a shame that I got to be 94 kilos because that's kind of like a waste of space. But if we stop talking about what's wrong and start talking about what's right, then intermittent fasting is one of the key ingredients in this book in terms of how to live to be 120 and have your marbles with you, right? So the big thing in this book is not to be 120 and not know who you are, how to be 120 and still running around the block. And so he makes a bunch of recommendations that, you know, you can explore all of that for yourself. I've gone whole hog on it. So what I mean by that is I'm doing the intermittent fasting. I'm training hard in the gym. I'm doing all those sort of things, not eating until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Bunch of other things, saunas, cold plunge pools, et cetera. And I've forgotten what I was saying. Forgotten why I was saying it. If you like it, pursue it. Oh, what he's saying is live to be 120. The generation after us will live to be 150. It's all based on the fact that aging is created by your DNA unraveling. And the protocols that he's put in place cause your DNA to fix themselves back up again. If you know about all that stuff, it's about telomeres and a thing called telomerase, which is created by this mononuclear acetic acid in your bloodstream, which we lose the ability to produce as we age. But pursue that for yourself. But I'm finding that within weeks of implementing what he's talking about, I've got more energy and more vibrance, and I reckon I wasn't short of it in the first place. So that's a fascinating thing. He put his father onto the protocol. His father retired at 67 years of age and got ready to go into a nursing home. At 80... So that's sometime after 67, but at 80, he put his father onto the protocol. His father went back to university, got another degree in a completely different field to what he'd got, spent the whole 3-4 years doing that, started running marathons and has been getting personal bests in the marathons. In other words, his third marathon was faster than his second and that was faster than his first. In other words, the guy's getting better as an athlete when he's 80. So I figure I'm going to give it a run. So I will report to you on progress, but you'll have to stay alive long enough to get the results. If we get back, so that might be, it's a shit of a read because it's all about technical stuff. If you just want the what to do, he about page 300 and something, he's got one page. So if you like that, what you do is you go in the bookshop, you go to page 300 and something, you get the one page, you photograph it, or you could say, Paul, have you done that? And I could just send you the photo. but just reach out to me and I'll handle that. My personal attitude about this sort of stuff is, sure, I'm happy to share with you the information. That one page is kind of gold. But I reckon when someone devotes a lifetime to the research and writes a freaking book about it, I owe them the $35 for the book to fund their life's effort, because the guy's 50 and put his life into it, but suit yourself. We need to look at this concept we were talking about before, and essentially what I was saying was that there are probably many more paradoxical aspects of our life than we've outlined on here. If you were to kind of go on the inner journey, then I'm pretty much guaranteeing satisfaction, fulfillment, and contentment in your life. In other words, we've been educated, in my view, wrongly, educated to pursue happiness. By definition, that means we haven't reached it. If you're pursuing it, it means you haven't caught it. So what we haven't been taught is, and we've been taught that happiness is a consequence of an accumulation of a bunch of achievements. Those achievements might be academic, they might be whatever, but they're never spiritual. They're all about have more, do more, be more, get more, own more, that kind of stuff. Most people, in fact, if you're sitting in this room or if you're behind that camera out there on your laptop, the chances are you've got to a point in your life where you've said to yourself, is this it? Because we've got a house and, you know, I've got a spouse and 2.2 children and a Volvo. If this is it, I've been ripped off. And so there must be more. The target really shouldn't be happiness. Happiness is an emotion. It will come and go like all the other emotions. But contentment, fulfillment, satisfaction, really what you want to do is you want to be able to answer the question, are you happy with your life? With yes. Or, put another way, when someone says, how you doing, how you going, how you traveling, the answer should be, I'm happy with my life. I'm happy with the way I live, the things I do, the places I go. I'm finding high levels of satisfaction and fulfillment in my life, not in a piece of it, not in the bit where I'm not at work or the bit where I am at work or the bit where I'm at sport or the whatever, but generally speaking. That means going on this inward journey, which we're going to focus on now. It's more on this inward journey. How do you be who you really are and get all this quagmire out of the way? So I'm going to talk about quagmire. But when I first started talking about quagmire, then Julie said to me, what is quagmire? Because you'd never seen the word before. And I said, it's when you're in a mess, hun. It's when you're in the swamp. So if the word swamp works for you, I'm going to talk about the swamp and how we create it and how we can get out of it. To do that, what we need to do, first of all, is talk about the real you. So I want to do some revision. For most of you out there, you'll have heard me say this, so I'm going to do it fairly quickly. I've alluded to it already, and really what I'm saying is on the inside of you, that's the real you. That what I had on the screen before about your soul or your essence or your core, I'm now representing it with that star. And I'm saying the real you, if you gave it a score out of 10, it would be 11. That makes sense? Okay, so that's the spiritual part of you, the essence, the core, or whatever. What happens is we're born that way. And most people's reaction to seeing a newborn is to go, oh, isn't it beautiful? Imagine someone saying that about you. Oh, isn't that baby beautiful? Don't even know what sex it is, don't know where it comes from, don't know who owns it. Isn't that baby beautiful? Why do people say babies are beautiful when they're not? Most babies don't have teeth. Hair, all the things that we don't put babies on the bonnet of a car in order to sell a car. We wait till they're 18 and put them on the bonnet of a car and that'll sell the car. Got it? So why do we say the baby's beautiful when it's not? Because we see it. We perceive this inner perfection, this magical thing. And I'm saying that's in you. But what happens is we get educated away from it. And the way we get educated away from it is we start to form a sense of our self-image of who we are. And, you know, that starts at a very early age because I go to school. That's when most of the damage is done. If you say to a three-year-old, are you beautiful? The answer is yes. Why do you keep asking me? So they know they are. We go to school and we notice we're not tall enough, not short enough, not something. And so We start to identify ourselves by signals outside of us, our body, our position, our parents' position, where we live, where we come from, what we're good at, what we're not good at. And you'll have heard a lot of this stuff about, you know, I'm good at sports and not so good at school, all that sort of stuff. I had a guy who used to work for us one time and I said, you know, what's your major qualification? He said, at school, I majored in play lunch. Really what he was saying to him is I was never an academic. So it's kind of like a way of identifying. So we do that. The problem is when we give ourselves a score at the self-image level, then the chances are we're not going to give ourselves 10 out of 10 because we see ourselves in some way as limited. So if I'm giving myself 7 out of 10, what's another way of saying 7 out of 10? Not perfect. In other words, three's missing. So what are the three that are missing? Well, for most people, the three that's missing, the three that I won't give myself, that's because of all the skeletons in the closet. So that's all the things I've said or done that I'm ashamed that I've ever said or done. They convince me that I'm not perfect, but what's happened is I've confused behavior with who I am. When I confuse behavior with who I am, then I get the skeletons in the closet thing. How much do I want you to know about the skeletons in the closet? That was a question. I don't. Why don't I want you to know? You might view me differently. In fact, I'm pretty sure you'll judge me. And when you judge me, what usually follows judgment is rejection. So I'm not so concerned about the judgment. I'm concerned about the consequences of the judgment, which is rejection in one form or another. And so I'm not sure that I will handle the rejection. I'm not sure that I will cope with that. There's actually nothing wrong with rejection. In fact, some people, you would look forward to being rejected by them. I can think of people who I think to myself, that would be a badge of honour if they rejected me, because they're such a dickhead that if they didn't reject me, then I'm worried that I might fit in. Got it? But most people don't see it that way. Most people look at rejection and fear, I won't survive the rejection. That the rejection is proof of what I already believe about myself, and that is there's something fundamentally wrong with me. So because I don't want you to find out about all my flaws and all that sort of stuff, what I do is I develop a personality or an ego. And what that personality or that ego does is keep you at a distance. It's an attempt to manufacture the way life is, to alter the circumstances so that I don't get hurt. Remember the example I gave before? Did I use this example? I can't remember. If I've got the hots for Kerry, Kerry's right, isn't it?
Yep.
If I've got the hots for Kerry, I'm not going to say, will you come out with me, because I'm afraid that of rejection, perhaps because she sees something in me that really what's going on is I'm afraid of the rejection, because if she's rejecting me, then to a degree I can see why. To a degree I recognise that this shortcoming that she hasn't mentioned, I feel that to be true. When you think about it, the only stuff that hurts is the stuff that somehow you agree with. That's a fascinating concept to think about. The only stuff that hurts is the stuff that, to a degree, you agree with. So because I figure I can't handle the rejection or the consequences of the rejection, I put in place this defensive mechanism called the personality or the ego. And the idea of that thing is that the rest of the world and its plans are now insulated from me by one degree. In other words, now I've got in position a thing that protects me a little bit. And so, you know, we've got all this stuff, you know, you ought to do this and you're lazy and blah, 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 and opinions and all the rest of it. If those things bounce off an external shield or barrier, I feel less hurt. I feel more protected. So the purpose of a personality or an ego is to stop you penetrating, to stop you getting on the inside where I'm more afraid that you can get hurt. You can hurt me. So far, so good? Now, diagrams never really work. You know, when we put this in a diagram, it's all kind of good, but, you know, there's so many kind of other angles to this that we kind of just have to sort of run with the general idea rather than the specifics. But really what I'm hoping here is that all that red stuff coming in bounces off the shield and I stay safe in the middle. The problem with me staying safe in the middle is if I'm stopping you from rejecting me, if I'm cutting off attack, so to speak, if I'm building a barrier around me, where can the attack come from? Oh, I'll attack myself regularly, but that's kind of like I'm in the habit of that. If I'm protecting myself from the outside world, where's the attack going to come from? From what direction is the attack going to come? This is such a curly question, you won't get it. Where can attack come from? From everywhere. The government's after you. The next door neighbours don't like you. People driving down the road trying to hit you. There are people out there trying to steal your identity. There are people who would take your money. Where can attack come from? Anywhere. Therefore, what shape is the wall I have to build around to protect myself? I kind of told you.
Is it like a force field?
It's a force field? Too sophisticated, mate. I'm an ex-woodwork teacher. The wall is going to be made out of bricks and concrete. What shape will it be? I'll give you a hint. It'll be circular, won't it? Okay. What does that mean? I'm trapped. Everyone's on the outside. I'm on the inside. What's the problem with being trapped? Nothing. Except isolation. Lack of connection. How do I feel my spirit? Well, I mostly feel my spirit when I look in the eyes of someone. We mostly meet when we open. How do you meet another human being when you're behind a brick wall? Let me answer that question for you. You don't. Therefore, we become trapped by our own safety mechanism. Got it? That's why I'm saying we have to dispense with it. So if we look at the eternal struggle that we all go through, pretty much it boils down to this. We give ourselves conflicting messages. So on the one hand, we're saying to ourselves, I've got to have goals, and apparently the more of those that I have and the closer I get to them, the better. But at another level, we're saying to ourselves, well, am I really just a goal-achieving mechanism, and does it really make any difference if I pay the house off, or is it Westpac that's happy? And does paying the house off, by the way, does that really turn me on, or is that just a change in circumstances? In other words, we say to ourselves, I want to do this, but really, what's the difference? And I think I've asked some of you in the room this question before. If we just gave you $5 million in cash, would it make much of a difference in your life? Yeah? There's people out there who've got it. What are you doing tonight for fun? That's a question I'm asking you guys, but I'm asking you guys in the room. What are you going to do for fun tonight? What's your plan, Sonia? What are you doing?
Hopefully watching a movie with boys, with a family.
Okay, so you're going to snuggle up with the husband and the boys and watch a movie. Righto, so what fucking difference does $5 million make to that?
Bigger telly.
You understand what I'm getting at? $5 million, $10 million, $20 million actually makes fuck all difference. Is this right or wrong? Sorry? Yeah. So we can look at it. You know, Mary's got this nice Mercedes. It's only a couple of years old. It's got all the fancy bits and does all that sort of stuff. Is it really worth it? How much better is that than, say, pick some other brand of car, like a Commodore or something, that costs maybe one third of the amount? How much better is it? Is it three times as better car? No, it's like that much better car. Because the car's the main part. Because half the world's population doesn't have a car. So the main part is a car that actually, when you put the key in, it actually starts and runs. That's 99% of the value of the car. Which car, whether it's got leather seats or regular seats, doesn't make much difference. Does that make sense? So what lots of people experience is, well, I'm supposed to be going after all these goals and targets, but really, what's the difference? And we get confused by that. Make sense? Okay, I've got a few examples of this. I'm supposed to be disciplined and never eat chocolate. No. or never drink Coke, or whatever it is. But you could be saying to yourself, but hang on, if there's no chocolate, what's the point? You know, you understand, I don't actually mean chocolate. I mean the bit that's fun in your life or whatever it is. Okay, so I've got a bunch of friends that I really treasure, but I really crave some me time. Have any of you had this? I love my friends, but I need some time to myself. Okay, so these things look to be conflicting. So I can build a solid and secure income, predictable, all that sort of stuff, then I'm going to be happy. But I don't even know if that's what I want. I don't even know if really I'd rather just dump the lot and go and meditate on a hill or be a monk or whatever. Or why can't I stop myself doing the things that are bad for me? Actually, I love doing things that are bad for me. Have any of you had that? Have any of you reveled in the joy of doing something naughty? I just need to know if I'm the only one. How many of you done something naughty just because it was naughty? Once again, I'm asking if I have any friends in the room. Okay. Or I really, really want this stuff. But I could live without it and not even notice. It's a staggering concept. You know, like I remember being much younger, and basically the meaning of life was whatever TV show was on at night. We'd come home from work or school even, and there was something on Tuesday night. We used to watch it, whatever it was. Nowadays, how many of you don't watch TV? How many of you watch by preference? In other words, you've got things you watch on YouTube or Facebook, or you've got a TV that feeds only what you want. So it's when you get the TV that feeds only what you want that you realise, hang on, did I want that stuff I was watching before? Does this make sense? One of the stories you guys have heard me tell over and over again is how being a school teacher trained me to be hungry at 10:30 in the morning. I can tell you when it's 10:30 every single day because my stomach tells me that I'm hungry. I know that that's a mindset issue, but I still get hungry. Happens at 10 to 12 as well. And so I spent most of my life trying to figure out how to not get hungry in the morning. And the obvious solution is eat. Any of you work this one out? Like the way to deal with hunger is eat? Yeah, well, I'm on top of that, right? Until we get into intermittent fasting and I'm not eating till 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm thinking to myself, what was all the drama about? Because I'm hardly missing it. There is a couple of minutes where I'm hungry where I have to say to myself, that's a mindset issue. That's not actually your stomach, mate. That's your memory or something. Does that fit? And I'm thinking to myself, 50 years wasted running around trying to make sure that there was something ready to eat at 10:30 because I'm going to get hungry then, so I've got to... And now I'm realising, hang on, did I really want that stuff? Or am I just a nutcase? And the short answer is, just a nutcase. Okay, so we could go on and on and on. Really, what happens is when you see all of this sort of stuff, somebody's going to say to you, you just have to find balance. How many of you heard that? You just have to find balance. Yeah, I'm going to say to you, well, balance is a kind of obvious thing, but it's not actually going to work because balance is going to throw you into imbalance. Because there are times when you need personal space and being with your friends is just not going to work. So that's what you need to do. But having a bit of personal space and a bit of with your friends, what the so-called balance, just means you didn't get enough personal space for it to work. Or there's times when you need to be with the people you care about and you don't need any personal space. But if you're trying to balance it, you're not going to get enough of being with who you need to connect with for that to work. So balance is impossible because no 2 days are the same. Does that fit? No 2 days are the same. Therefore, let's have a look at how we build self-esteem. Because what you'll notice is that as soon as I describe this, you'll notice that you keep a mental scoreboard. This is one of the worst things you can ever do to yourself. And that is what I mean by a mental scoreboard is that you talk about things that you're okay at or that you're good at or that you do well or whatever. Does that make sense? We could make a list of things, and maybe we could make the list longer, but that wouldn't really make much difference, because the next list, is it longer or shorter? So for most of us, our list is imbalanced. And this is how we create poor self-esteem, is that we say, well, there's more here, and this is much more permanent than that. And I deliberately put, I won a race on there, because one day I came top in maths. And that was a shock to me, the school teacher, and the whole class. But apparently it worked, and I came top in maths. So how long did that last? How long did that victory last for me? Yeah, I wish it lasted 2 weeks. It lasted 10 minutes until I realised a girl who always come tops in maths, she was away that day. So how long does I won a race last? So what do we do with these lists? Have I talked to you guys about these lists? Okay, so what do we do with them?
We forget the good stuff and we remember the bad stuff.
Yeah. Someone pays us a compliment and we go, ah, just lucky.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you too.
Yeah. Okay, so what we do with that list is undermine it, erode it, actively deactivate all of the stuff that's on that list. For summary's sake, let me say what we do is we undermine it, and what happens is that that's a continuous process. It's not just a once only, it's a continuous process. So far, so good? What do we do with the other list? We grow it. It's kind of like we're fertilising it, right? It's kind of like I've found fertiliser for my brain, mate, and I'm going to feed it right into the bit that I don't like. And so I'm going to pick one here and emphasise that I'm lazy, right? Now, that's probably not a great example for me because I'm probably... how many of you are lazy periodically? Yeah, I'm fantastic at being lazy, but generally I don't do it. But if I'm going to do it, mate, you just watch me sit on a lounge and do nothing for hours on end. Staggering concept. I've got a favourite TV show, but it's a feed me one. Does that make sense? It's not on the TV, it's on the... and whatever. And Jules said to me the other day, do you want to watch some more of that? I said, no, I just watched 4 episodes. I don't need another episode at this point. So I can do lazy. So whatever. What happens with that is that I don't just leave it. What happens is I reinforce it and I start going over it and I go over it and blow over it. And, you know, if it's I had an affair, then I'm going to reinforce that one as well. And if it's kind of whatever, I sleep in too much, then I'm going to keep reinforcing it. And so what am I doing here? What do you see happening? So again?
Put ourselves down.
We put ourselves down. The biggest problem you've got, the biggest person rejecting you is you. So I fear rejection from whoever I'm talking to or whatever. But in actual fact, the most amount of damage is done by me to me. So what is the solution? Well, here's our list. I'd like to hear your ideas on the solution because I'm stuck with this stuff. Right? I can't change what's on the list. I could change, I'm lazy, I suppose, but a lot of the things that are on our list are in the past, so that they're not going to be able to be changed. So what do we need a new strategy here. I'll give you a hint. Stick with undermine and reinforce. Stick with red and purple. Do you want me to take you back to the... Stick with red, stick with purple, but let's look at a new strategy. Okay, it's pretty simple. What we've got to do is swap them around. That's difficult for most people to do because we're taught that we don't go around talking about how great we are. But you need to between your ears. If that's difficult to focus on, get a victory book. And at the end of each day, just get an old exercise book or a cheap one or whatever, because you're probably going to throw it away. But a victory book is where you write down what you succeeded at today. So keep it beside your bed and just before you go to sleep. By the way, if you have kids, this is the best thing in the world. 3 things that you succeeded at today. Just write them down, draw a line, we'll say another three tomorrow. So victory books work. Because they cause that change of focus. Simple, practical, easy to do. If you've got kids, let them see you using the victory book. Because when they see you using the victory book, they're going to say, "Mum or Dad, what are you doing?" You can say, "I'm just writing down what I did well at today." "Why are you doing that, Mum or Dad?" "Well, because it helps me to feel good about what I did today and not so pay so much attention to what I messed up and all that sort of stuff." And I'll guarantee you, if that child is under 10, they're going to ask, are they allowed to have one? If they're over 10, they're probably going to go and get their own and keep it in secret. What do we do with the other stuff? Find ways to undermine it. Easiest way to undermine these things is to find where the lesson was. What did you learn from it? Why is it a great experience? How does it enhance you as a human being? What is the lesson you will carry for the rest of your life as a consequence of that thing? How has it made you a better person? That's the easiest way to undermine it. I've got some animations that are going crazy here, so pardon me while I press the button madly. I think I went inadvertently backwards. Whoops. Okay. So, oh shit, I did it again.
You're just reinforcing it.
Hey, put a bit of technology in a Gumby's hands and what do you get? Okay, so let's have a look at it from this point of view. Really what we want to do is put as much energy as we can into improving our self-image, because you're just not going to perform at a level higher than the way that you see yourself. So the way forward for most people in terms of more success or more of what you want is to spend less time on how and more time on who. Less time on how do I do this and more time on who do I need to become to do this. So let's have a look at it from the point of view of how we put this into the paradoxes that I was talking about before. But really, before I go from this page, have you all got it? Got the notes how you want them? Really what I'm saying is you're never going to get a dividend as good as the one that you put into improving self-esteem. Okay, so if we look at how that applies to the paradoxes, if we just grab one at random, and I've grabbed the easiest one that's a vertical one, so it gives me the most room on the page. I could have chosen any of them. But essentially what we can say is, okay, so pretty much the truth about this is that we need to give ourselves enough of what we want so that we can feel like life is worth it and it's fun, etc. Understanding that there are things that we need to do so that we can have everything that we want, and both ends of the thing are true. That in the middle of our experience of this is our inner self. And that what happens is that we need to look at where you are biased. So there's training in your background that's going to push you either side of the middle. So what is the position that you habitually inhabit on that scale? So this is where we kind of get you to do a kind of subjective reading on yourself and say, okay, what am I most driven by? What I need or what I want? So I'm going to get you to draw a line and put a dot on it, understanding that this dot is really subjective and you shouldn't pay too much attention. We don't want to actually waste too much time getting the difference between 6.3 and 6.4, right? Just anywhere between 5 and 7 will do for this kind of thing. Really, just which side of the middle do you tend to be on most often? Now, it's true that you'll find yourself at both ends. So there's plenty of chocolate in your life and there's plenty of no chocolate. We get that. But how do you approach things? What's the background approach? Does that make sense? I'll give you a classic example. My background approach for many years has been from here, about 9 out of 10 up here, because what I want matters, and the rest of it we'll sort that out later. Make sense? That's why we're broke when we're 40. Was that up until the time we were broke, we were driving Mercedes-Benz convertibles and all that sort of stuff. We had a great big house and da-da-da. No real attention to what we needed, which was to pay down the mortgage. The mortgage got big enough that we couldn't jump over it, and that sucked all the money, and the cars had to go, and blah, 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 and we had to start again. Pretty classic story. So far, so good. Of course, when we look at relationships, I might have been married to someone whose habitual position on this line is the opposite. And so when I would say, let's get a new car, Mary would say, we need to divert that money to something else. So far, so good. That would be the source of an argument that could go for years. Because of a non-appreciation of the other person's position and an insistence that our position is the correct one. So far, so good? All right. Let me just show you a couple of things about this in terms of how we work with this, because my personal circumstances don't really matter. It's more about how you go with this. What you'll find is crossing from one end to the other. Remember that? Satisfaction, fulfillment, all of those great things in life are most likely to turn up if you can get from one end to the other at light speed. And I'm suggesting that you'll move most easily through the part of you that has no opinion. Does that make sense? There's a part of me that watches what's going on and doesn't care what I drive. There's an ego that says what you drive matters. There's a part of me that says, if you've got a roof over your head, that's enough. There's another part of me that says, no, it has to be a pretty fancy roof. Does that fit? So this holiday I'm talking about, we're going on this holiday, we'll take the three-year-old and the kids and we'll go to this beach we've been to for years before. The ego part of me says we have to rent a place that's on the beachfront. That make sense? The inner part of me says anywhere near the beach would be fine. Got it? Okay. So the bit that moves easily, the bit that is unmoved by the circumstances around us is this inner you. And we need to tap into that as much as we can because it creates range of movement. It gives me freedom. It allows me to not be hooked on the current deal. Because you see, when they ring me up and say, we'll give you a discount if you book that house now, then the ego part of me says, well, we have to have the place that's on the beach. We have to book now. We have to pay more money. The inner part of me says, bugger it, they can come here for a holiday. We can still have as much fun. Because what does it take to have the fun? Well, as Sonia said, grab the people you care about, get them together. If you don't like watching movies, cook something. Or go for a walk or play with the dog or... Does that make sense? Okay, so the inner part of us moves really easily and quickly and doesn't need an opinion and is not really affected by what's going on. Remember, we did a deal in the US in 1988 where we put $100,000 in and lost it. And it went up in smoke pretty quickly. The ego part of me said... Fill in the blanks for me. The ego part said, this is bad. Make sense? The inner part of me said, when I tap into the inner part of me, they go, that's easy to find, learning experience, should have checked that out a bit more, should have done a bit more due diligence, blah, 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 blah. The ego part of me can just regret it still to this day. None of this gets the $100,000 back, by the way. So you understand what I mean by ease and grace? It's where we need to be and understand that all of these things that we think we have a relationship with, we don't really. Now, that's surrounded by our self-esteem or our self-image, and that's where we bring ego and conflict and struggle in, and this is where the inner battle takes place, because now what's happening is there's a fight going on with me within me saying, which one is true? What's true, the 100 grand lost bad or the 100 grand lost being nothing really? They're both true. The question is, are you going to terrorize yourself? Or understand it's just a thing. Does that make sense? And that's why I say you can move easily and quickly. Therefore, when you look at it, really what we want to do is we want to increase the range of movement by working on removing a lot of this stuff. So I kind of put this purple arrow there saying, okay, so you can get a range of movement by getting this stuff and getting it out of the way. So this is just to remind you what we had before and say, here's the solution. The range of movement becomes greater when you dump the ego, personality, self-image. Even self-image is not such a great thing. It's great if it's positive, but that's better than if you have a negative self-esteem, but really it's kind of fairly restrictive as well. Really what we want to do is focus on the inner self and make that as big as we possibly can. In fact, if that's your journey, if that's the range of movement that you've got, I'm going to suggest your next job is extend the range of movement. More connection with you. We're saying, you know this to be the truth as well, all of the power in the world is within you. You're the one who changes the circumstances. You're the one who makes your world different. True or not? I'm going to remind you about the three people in the dark room. One of them's having a terrifying experience. The other's having a fantastic experience. The other one's flicking between the two. Three people, different experience in the same environment, because your perception actually does create your reality, because we can measure it in your bloodstream. Therefore, the trick is to go within. So we have a history of taking people away at Christmas or just before Christmas on cruises and things. So back when we were doing live gigs, we would give away a holiday on a cruise or another place as an incentive to buy some of our other products. Delightful thing. What it meant was for about 6 or 7 years, every December we would take about 100 people somewhere. We used to do this with our friends Andrew and Daryl and Matt and Amanda Clarkson, and so we're all doing that. We end up in Thailand and the monks come to bless us. That's fantastic, because I'm the head of the organisation. They say, you can talk to the chief monk. So you get an audience with the monk. I go, this is fantastic, right? So you beauty, I'm off to talk to the monk. We get talking and he just talks like a regular person. I thought I was going to get, you know, some kind of inner wisdom that was going to change me. I was looking for the, look, I'll give you a dollar, could you give me the meaning of life thing? And he just wanted to talk. And so it transpires that he has a brother in Melbourne. And he said, you know, it's interesting, you're from Australia. I have a brother in Melbourne. I go, oh, how long since you've seen your brother? And he said, oh, I visited a couple of years ago. He said, oh, one day I will go to Melbourne. And I thought, oh, I'm onto something here. I said, well, when are you going to Melbourne? He said, oh, well, when it happens. I go, when will it happen? He goes, when it happens. I go, well, are you going to make it happen? He says, well, if I wanted to make it happen, he said, I would meditate on whether I was interfering with the world flowing. He said, but if it became obvious to me to go to Melbourne, he said, I'd go to the bus stop. I said, well, what are you going to do at the bus stop? He said, wait to see if someone buys me a ticket to go to the airport. I said, huh? He goes, you have to let life flow, and if I'm meant to go to Melbourne, I'll be on the bus. I go, do people do that? And of course, in Thailand, it's a very traditional thing to support a monk doing whatever. And in this particular order, they used to carry a bowl but never ask for food, because their belief system – says if you're meant to eat, it'll end up in the bowl. They don't want to interfere with how, because they reckon that's interfering with your ability to make it happen, like just attract it. So we think we understand law of attraction. The Buddhists understand law of attraction and have done for 5,000 years. What they say is if you're meant to eat, food will turn up, and if you're not meant to eat, you're not. And I said, ha! I said, I've got you now. So what if nobody buys you a ticket on the bus to go to the airport? And he said, then I'll be meditating on stillness. He said, I'll be meditating on sitting here. I go, well, you'll get hungry. He says, possibly. I said, what will you do then? He goes, well, I'll be meditating on hunger and the meaning of hunger and my body's relationship with this concept called hunger. I go, well, if that goes on long enough, you're going to starve to death. And he goes, well, and then I'll be meditating on death. And I go to myself, this guy's got a much deeper inner life than I've got, because I would solve these problems by... How would you solve these problems? Throw money at the problem. Which, does that solve the problem? Or does it delay the problem? It delays the problem, because guess what? You are going to die. Just so I'd remind you. Make sense? So we need to expand our inner selves as much as we possibly can. Got it? What I want to do now is show you how you can recognize that you're not doing it. So I'm going to go back to the paradoxes and say, look, if you really want to know about it, here it is in writing. And I'm going to suggest you don't bother writing this stuff down. I'll give you the slides, because it's more important to get the concept, because I want to do this stuff faster than you can write it. You okay with that?
Yeah.
All right, so what's at the wants end? Well, if you don't want a bit of stillness, if you don't want a bit of connection, if you don't want a bit of playing, if you don't want a bit of fellowship with your fellow human beings, what do you want? So what you're going to get at the wants end is things that are going to add value to life. Does that make sense? Okay. Is it also true that what you need is to stay fit and healthy and get enough rest and recreation and nutrition and learning and investment and abstinence and mindset for your life to actually work? Is that true? Okay, so when you get to the needs end, when you start working on what you need, it all comes down to a fairly simple bunch of stuff. Got it? Okay. If you're experiencing either end, and what's going to stay on the screen for you is one end and the other end. See those words, one end and the other end? That's going to stay constant. I'm just going to change the wants and needs thing and what you get at each end. What to watch out for is what we call a quagmire in the middle, where you're trying to find balance. What's going to happen when you don't have what you can get at either end is your ego is going to run the show. You'll find yourself getting emotionally upset. I've used the word tantrums because I'm looking for words that can fit inside an oval. But you understand what I mean by when you get cranky or you get shitty or you get whatever. And if we use the childhood terms, it might make it more accessible for you. If you are unable to produce what you need and what you want, then when some of it appears, you'll grab it. It's kind of like scarcity. People who are hungry grab food. People who are short of money grab money. People who are short of time grab time. You know what? You understand what I mean by snatch and grab? We get nasty about it. And then you'll find yourself busy for status reasons rather than for gain or purpose or inner challenge or things that are going to have meaning for you. And this is what I noticed showing up in the three-year-old. Mine. Fascinating the other day. We get ice creams. So, by the way, how much is a Magnum for five people?
Quite expensive.
A fucking fortune, right? Who invented those ice creams?
Marketers.
People who got them boats. So we spent $100 on ice creams and we're all kind of tasting each other's, but not the three-year-old. She's got hers. She's going, mine. I'm going, you want to taste mine? Nope. Can I taste yours? Nope, mine. go, yeah, interesting. It's kind of like a smallness about, now she's kind of going through a growth session and trying to identify who she is and what's hers and all those sort of things. There's probably good things about it. But as an adult, possessiveness is an ugly thing. So what you'll find is that you do things that are ugly. When you're stuck in the middle and you haven't been able to get to one end or the other, what you'll find is that things are just not good here. We compare ourselves to other people or other situations or even our past, and we get judgmental. Does that make sense? So really what I wanted to do with this is say to you, okay, this, watch this. Here's your signals. Here's your signals that you're not living spiritually. What's happened is you've got into the part of you that's participating in the world and you got stuck there. And you're reading the signals and treating them as if they're true. The need for possessiveness simply says, I lack something. No, you don't. If you get to your spirit, what do you lack? Well, spiritually, if you've got air and water and shelter and a few other basics, spiritually you don't need anything. Does that make sense? You might desire, you might want connection with others that reflect you. In other words, I see myself through the mirror of the interactions we have. Does that make sense? Got it. So, that being the case, what do I need spiritually? Nothing really. I just need to connect with other spirits. If you look at this stuff, it's all about, got to have it or else. Got to have it or life is bad. What I'm suggesting is 90% of the population spend 90% of their time stuck here. So watch yourself and watch others, because trying to work with someone who's in here is near impossible. And for those of you who are coaches, what you'll find is that when you're working with someone who's stuck in here, this stuff is gobbledygook to them. It doesn't make sense. Getting people out of here, or getting themselves to get themselves out of there, is actually the key. Because once you get them out, and some people you need a crowbar, but once they get out, then they can flip to one end or the other and things are going to be sweet again. That makes sense? Nobody really likes being like this. But it might be their preferred position. It might be their habitual state.
Are you saying that so long as you're at one end or the other, it's okay? Or do you think we still need at some times to go from one end to the other?
Practically speaking, I'm trying to get across the idea that we've got to get backwards and forwards a lot. And you're the only person who can talk about how much at which end for you. The problem that I come across every day in my work is people stuck in the middle. And pick a side.
Can you ever be too much of one side?
Oh, yeah, you can. And it will tell you. Like, too much chocolate is pretty obvious. Too much alcohol, pretty obvious. You know, too much space. Too much aloneness. Too much solitude. So if you're self-observant, and I guess that's probably the key thing here, is if you're willing to work on your self-awareness, then you can get too much of either end, and that by itself should be the signal. You know, if you look at your connection with other human beings, I'm saying that the easiest form of spiritual existence is to meet another person heart to heart, to see myself reflected in another. I can see myself better in my interactions with others than I can with myself. But only that is one-dimensional. I need space where I can be introspective and see myself without those filters or without that reflection, those kind of things. So, yeah, I think the big problem, Trey, is that we tend to think that there's an ideal spot. And I don't think there is an ideal spot. I think when you're doing one end or the other, you should do it properly. Don't leave half the chocolate in the fridge.
That's what I did.
Leave half the bottle of wine.
Yeah.
But I think if you're going to play, don't play half-assed. I think that we We participate reluctantly, wondering if we are doing the right thing or not. So I think that my experience says, go wholeheartedly to either end, but don't spend too long there because you probably need to get back the other end. There is as many benefits as the other end. It's a little bit like, you know, you guys have heard me tell this story about doing two things at once. I was writing the book on personality and we were helping this kid recover from a heroin addiction. So he was living with us and I had him going off and getting rocks in the ute and coming back. And when he had a ute full of rocks, I would come out of the office and we would build rock walls in the backyard. So what I noticed was that it was difficult to start both activities. So when I was writing, I used to have to type in, I'm Paul Blackburn sitting here and I've got no fucking idea what to say and blah, 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 blah. But if I got started, it would start to work and then I'd just delete the first bit. Same with building rock walls. You grab rocks and you drop them on your feet. Or they go in the wrong spot. But after a while, you get into a rhythm and you can see a spot and you can see a rock and you go, if I flip that upside down, it'll fit perfectly and boom, and in it goes and it's there 20 years later. So what I noticed was I could do these two different things, and this one was a holiday from that one and that one was a holiday from that one. And so there wasn't really a rest in between. It was just I was getting, figuratively speaking, I was getting from one end to the other and doing it quickly. And I noticed that the sooner I just dumped it, so when Brad would turn up in the backyard with the rocks, I would just dump the writing instantly, even if I was in the middle of a sentence, and go, time to do that. Basically, life is telling me. Otherwise, he would have turned up 15 minutes later or 15 minutes earlier. So life's telling me that's it now. So off I go to do rocks because that must be what I need. Does that fit? And that's a beautiful period in my life. It's intense work because if you've ever tried to write something and you get words to make sense, you can understand there's a lot of fooling around with that. Well, it's intense work heaving rocks as well. But both of them delightful if you dive into the challenge. If you let yourself go into the challenge, both of them delightful. Trying to balance them. Trying to tell Brad to pick up rocks quicker or slower. Or saying to myself, oh, he shouldn't have turned up now. I need to write more. I'm just on a roll. That's all kind of like heavy and difficult. That makes sense? I'm not saying I got this right. I just notice these things about what's easy and what's hard. Give yourself a ranking between desire and detachment. For most of us, we struggle with this one. So we've got to look at it from this point of view. Desire is what gets you there. Detachment is what means you can get there. So desire is I want to do it. Detachment is I can. Because I'm not attached. So we talk about, I usually use a winning at Wimbledon illustration. So when we talk to whoever's going into the grand final at Wimbledon tomorrow and say, what is your plan for tomorrow? They're going to say, I really want this title. I've never won it before, or I've won it before and I want to win it again. I really, really want it. And my game plan is I'm just going to go out and see if I can enjoy my tennis. Meaning, if I can just turn this into like another game of tennis instead of an important game of tennis, I'm detaching from the result. It's not going to give me more meaning. Does that make sense? Okay. So where do you reckon you are on this scale? Once again, intuitively, give yourself a spot where you reckon you habitually are. And if you're looking at where I would go, then I'm just way up here. Ridiculously up here. But I rationalise that by saying, but that's what gives me my drive. But I need to be more detached. I need to be more things don't matter. When I'm working on myself spiritually, then what I'm working on is how can I let this go and embrace this more easily. We usually show that with this diagram. So any of you not seen this diagram aside from Kerry? You all seen this diagram? Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is a Yerkes-Dodson curve. It talks about the relationship between stress and performance. And really what we're saying, Kerry, is that if stress is grasped graphed along here and performance is up there, then what happens is that the way that we perform is that we peak. And then when the stress becomes too much, our performance deteriorates. Therefore, there's a performance zone where we're going to get the most out of ourselves. To get into that zone and to stay into that zone, we have to practice this blend of I really, really want it, but it doesn't matter. I said practice, meaning your car's beautiful, but it's a bucket of bolts. Your house is magic, but it's a collection of sticks. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Clear with that? Okay. So when we look at desire and detachment, what do you get? Well, desire is a thing that pushes you forward when it comes to actually working on something and wanting to learn and focus and setting goals and making plans and those kind of things. Very difficult to make plans if there's no desire to have what it is you're planning to have. You know, our greatest experience, I think, as a couple for Mary and I was deciding we're going to bring our kids up in the bush and build this big house. So we go and do that. So there's all sorts of plans around that. What we didn't plan on was going broke. But if you said to me, what do I value the most in my life? It's those experiences that we had whilst we were living in that caravan. So the relationship between me and Mary got better and with the kids, etc. The advantages of detachment are pretty obvious. If you can let go, then what it means is you can practice forgiveness. Forgiveness is for who, by the way? It's you who lets go. It allows you to depersonalize things. The great thing about detachment is you can get a better view, a helicopter view of what's going on and not be stuck in your own version of it. Emotional intelligence is a way of practicing non-involvement so that I can figure out what's the best thing to say or do. And here's a big one, mystery. So what I'm going to suggest to you is you put a circle around the word mystery. Mystery is one of the parts of life that's magical because if you admit that you don't know what's about to happen, you can enter into the concept that God or the universe could actually provide magic just because you're open to it. Connected to that is wonder. And if you don't have wonder in your life, if you're not marveling at things, you're really focused on the details. So mystery and wonder are really important parts of an emotional high-level experience. How will you know if you're stuck in the middle? Well, neediness is probably the most obvious one. So when we're feeling, I need that, I've got to have this, then obviously the desire has been amped up. When we can't forgive, then what that means is we can't detach from it. We're allowing it to have meaning beyond what it really meant. And that, of course, is going to lead to resentment and lack of forgiveness. Really, that's about being self-centered and saying what goes on for me is more important than what goes on around us. What it indicates is I'm being small, that I'm unable to expand my view into the helicopter position. And the consequence of that, when you think about it, basically that's emotional immaturity. Is that I'm saying I'm not big enough to be better than that. I can't grow above it. The way that most people handle that is they go for blacks and whites, goods and bads and those kind of things. And so that's where you'll see racism show up or bigots or whatever. And everything's either right or wrong and there's no grey. Any experience of life would tell you that there's a shitload of grey. But we need to be okay with it. So that goes into the right and wrong thing. The judgments, all that sort of stuff. So what's this grey stuff mean? What am I saying here? What's the message here? The overall message?
When you recognise any of those, you need to get to one end pretty quickly.
When I find myself doing this, wake up. Look. I'm not saying you can't be like this. I'm saying don't sink in there. Don't let it be quicksand. If we go to being and doing, then give yourself a ranking for that. How much do you do and how much do you be? Where's your preferred position? Remember, this is a subjective judgment. I'm going to put one thing on there just to remind you. You are probably a human being. That's a fairly safe bet we can make about you. You're probably a human being.